We, from the left, reject U.S. intervention and insist on the fact that it's not for the United States to decide who won the election. But in Venezuela, according to the ballots that are in the hands of citizens, it's quite clear that there's a violation of the electoral laws. If the basic mechanism established in the Electoral Council for guaranteeing that the results are free, that the elections are free, is the comparison between the printed ballots and the signed documents at each voting booth with the totals presented by Electoral Council. This is the main of several mechanisms to guarantee that the elections really reflect, the results reflect the will of the people. If the government refuses to show their results and just makes up some random numbers, there's no way that the Venezuelan society can trust what the results are. It's obvious that the government denies the possibility of doing what the law requires it to do, which is to present each voting booth result.
Nina Farnia,
it refuses to do so. It's very clear.
We gave Edgardo Lander the first word. We give you the last.
First of all, I want to correct Professor Lander. The Venezuelan government, according to the laws that we learned about while we were there, has 30 days to release the tallies from the day of the election. We're not even at 10 days yet. Second of all, it's not up to the international left to decide who the president of Venezuela is. It's up to the Venezuelan people. And it's difficult for me to trust somebody who is known to have met with the widely discredited figure Juan Guaido about what the Venezuelan left should or shouldn't do, or whether or not the Maduro government is a leftist government. The Venezuelan people, it looks like, based on our perceptions of the process, of the election process, chose President Maduro. But to the extent that there's disagreement about what actually happened, the Supreme Court should be allowed to decide, not Secretary of State Blinken, who came out last week saying Venezuela needs to transition away from socialism, or anybody else. It's up to the Venezuelan people. Venezuela has been subject to hybrid warfare, which includes election tampering, severe sanctions, targeted assassinations. Just this morning, a Democratic official was assassinated. The Venezuelan people have the right to challenge U.S. interference and U.S. imperialism, and they get to decide who their president is, not the international left, not Secretary of State Blinken, no one else.
We want to thank you both so much for being with us. And, of course, we're going to continue to follow this issue in Venezuela. Nina Farnia is a legal historian at Albany Law School. She volunteered with the National Lawyers Guild as an election observer in Venezuela. And we want to thank Edgardo Lander. Edgardo Lander is a sociologist in Caracas, Venezuela. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to a major investigation by The Washington Post into Donald Trump's relationship with the Egyptian government, which reportedly tried to funnel $10 million in cash to Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. The cash weighed about 200 pounds when it was withdrawn from a state-run bank in Cairo at the request of an organization linked to the Egyptian intelligence service, just 5 days before Trump took office as president in 2017. The Post reports Trump earlier gave the same amount to his own campaign, and investigators suspected Trump expected to be repaid by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. But questions about the transaction went unanswered by the Justice Department under Trump's Attorney General Bill Barr, who closed the case, citing, quote, a lack of sufficient evidence, a decision one DOJ official called jaw-dropping. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C., by one of the reporters who broke the story. Carol Lenig is a national investigative reporter for The Washington Post, who focuses on White House and government accountability. Her new piece is headlined, $10 million cash withdrawal drove secret probe into whether Trump took money from Egypt. Carol, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you start off with how you began this story in The Washington Post.
My colleague Aaron Davis and I began this work while we were doing research for a book about the Justice Department under Donald Trump and under President Biden. In that research, we discovered far more details than we expected about an incredibly secretive probe. This probe began in early 2017 with what investigators at the Department of Justice called jaw-dropping intelligence. The CIA alerted the Department of Justice days after Donald Trump was elected that they had what they considered pretty reliable information from an informant indicating that the president of Egypt planned or wanted to or ordered $10 million injected into Donald Trump's then candidate, Donald Trump's campaign to help him get reelected. That would be illegal, and hiding that money would be money laundering. And if Donald Trump had taken that money, it would potentially be bribery and compromise of a sitting president by a foreign government. DOJ investigators saw this as extremely disturbing and worrisome, and eventually alerted top officials at the department, who decided that Robert Mueller should take on the investigation. He had just newly been appointed in May of 2017 and was looking into foreign interference by Russia in the 2016 election. And now they wanted him to also look at this secret matter. Nothing about this was ever known to the public at the time. What happened next in the next phase was that Mueller's team, almost as they are shutting down their office in 2019, finally win a lengthy appeals court battle, a secret one that closed down the federal courthouse in D.C. to sort of conceal the nature of the debate inside the hearing room. They obtain a record that seems to corroborate the intelligence. It shows that there was a $10 million cash withdrawal, very mysterious, people walking out of a bank branch near the Cairo airport with a large portion of all the U.S. bills then in the entire Egyptian banking system in duffel bags. No one signs for it. It comes out of a spy-linked account. And the reason this was so important, Amy, was obviously $10 million in cash walking out of a bank is a big deal, but it came out of the account linked to Egypt's spy agency, essentially Egypt's CIA. And that is what the original intelligence suggested, that El-Sisi, the president of Egypt, wanted to use his spy agency to get the money to Trump. So these things were lining up, but Mueller is leaving the building. He is now closing shop in early 2019 and hands off this investigation to the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. The boss of this investigation ultimately is the new Attorney General, Bill Barr. It's run by the U.S. Attorney, Jesse Liu, who tells her investigators this is pretty impressive stuff, but she wants to brief Barr on the matter. An investigation of a sitting president has to be briefed to the attorney general, but she returns from meeting with him and reviewing the evidence at the CIA with a different posture. Investigators feel that she's done a 180. She was supportive of them continuing this investigation, and now she is telling them she doesn't want to approve their subpoena for Trump's bank records. These records were key in their view to determine, did the money from Cairo that was mysteriously withdrawn 5 days before Donald Trump was elected, did it somehow return in some form to any of Donald Trump's personal or campaign accounts? And they were blocked from doing that.
So, Carol Lenig, talk about the meeting that, at the time, presidential candidate Donald Trump had with Sisi on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. That took place in the fall, months before President Trump took office.
Yes, this meeting was very interesting to investigators later, and here are the two reasons why. Donald Trump was trying to burnish his foreign policy credentials and bona fides. He didn't have a lot of experience in government, as he has already acknowledged himself. And so he wanted to show that he could make deals with foreign governments and foreign leaders. He could establish important relationships. He meets with el-Sisi on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly, which is held each year, and it's September 20th, 2016. At that time, Donald Trump's campaign was cash-starved. He was running out of money, and his advisors were trying to convince him to cut a check from his own accounts to help fund the last little bit of media buys that the campaign needed to purchase in order to stay, you know, vibrant and alive in the race. And he did not want to put any more of his own money in the campaign because he thought he was going to lose. But after he meets el-Sisi, and he does this privately, Amy, some of it's public, but some of the meeting is just him, el-Sisi, and an interpreter from Egypt. And investigators found that very curious, because then on October 28th, a month later, Donald Trump does agree to write a check to his own campaign after much, much pleading from his advisors. Investigators saw this as an important moment. Why, if Donald Trump had been absolutely insisting he wouldn't donate to his campaign anymore, he finally did. Mm.
So, Carol Lenig, you write in the piece, this would be an answer to the question, well, why would Sisi want to have sway over President Trump? You write, over the course of his presidency, Trump shifted U.S. policy in ways that benefited the Egyptian leader, a man he once called my favorite dictator. In 2018, Trump's State Department released $195 million in military aid the U.S. had been withholding over human rights abuses, a move that had been opposed by his first Secretary of State, followed by the release of $1.2 billion more in such assistance. Carol Lenig.
You know, Donald Trump's really flipped the switch on U.S. policy towards Egypt. You may, and your listeners may know, that el-Sisi was viewed by the United States as both an ally, but a worrisome ally. Egypt's very important to the United States' position in the Middle East, but el-Sisi had risen to power through a violent coup, a military coup. And in the wake of his rise to power, it became known that he was suspected to have played a key role in the military killing of supporters of his opponent who'd been democratically elected. He was also viewed as very comfortable with a host of human rights abuses against opponents and critics in his country and trying to violently shut down that opposition, using military and spy power to do that. So the United States viewed him with a little bit of remove and had put a hold on this very valuable military aid and had asked him and pressed him numerous times to do better on human rights at home. But when Donald Trump got into office, he didn't have any of those restrictions. He insisted that one of his first officials that he was going to meet as president was el-Sisi, something his own advisors encouraged him not to do because that was showing too much support to the Egyptian president. Rex Tillerson, his then Secretary of State, counseled Trump not to release this military aid, that it would be too generous. And el-Sisi had done nothing to improve his record on democracy and free and fair elections and human rights record, nothing. And so Trump fired Tillerson and ordered the release of this aid.
Finally, Carol, in the years since the Egypt case was closed, you write, the Sisi regime's ambitions to influence senior U.S. government officials have been laid bare by the bribery conviction of New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez, the former chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Can you draw that line, a man who is about to be sentenced in October, just before the election?
Well, the key thing to know here is there was a very full and expansive investigation with no holds barred to figure out, was Senator Menendez a foreign agent of the Egyptian government? There were records searched, encrypted signals, communications gathered, And what they found was he was receiving money from an Egyptian national who was doing the bidding of Egyptian spy and military leaders, and ultimately from the Sisi regime. He was giving information to the Egyptian officials at high levels, including information that was deemed secret by our U.S. government about our U.S. personnel in the Egyptian embassy. And what is also, to me, really striking, Amy, is El-Sisi has relied on his Egyptian version of the CIA, called the General Intelligence Service, to push his agenda abroad in the United States and to tamp down criticism at home. And here, the General Intelligence Service was a critical feature of reaching out to and intervening and directing Senator Menendez. And it was the General Intelligence Service accounts from which the $10 million in the Donald Trump investigation had been withdrawn 5 days before Donald Trump was elected. The same agency, the same government account, was, according to the intelligence, at work trying to find a way to get money to Donald Trump. But that investigation was not allowed to proceed.
Carol Lenig, we just have 20 seconds. Could this bribery investigation into Donald Trump be reopened?
The information could be gathered. There could be an investigation that looked more deeply and looked at the actual records the original investigators wanted to. But the chances for prosecuting anyone who played a role in this and committed a crime are extremely low. The statute of limitations is over, and it's unlikely that that could change.
Carol Lenig, national investigative reporter for The Washington Post, will link to your exclusive report written with Aaron Davis. $10 million cash withdrawal drove secret probe into whether Trump took money from Egypt. Next up, we speak with a member of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrow. She lost her sister on 9/11. And we'll talk about the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's decision to revoke a plea deal by three prisoners still at Guantanamo. Stay with us.
And everything's been so American. The early times is finished, and the wanted's all arrayed. Everyone's been sold American, been dreaming dreams in a rollaway bed. Writing down your memoirs on some window in the frost.
Sold American by Kinky Friedman, who died in June at the age of 79. In addition to being a musician and writer, Kinky was an independent candidate for Texas governor in 2006. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has revoked a plea deal for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two other men held at Guantanamo accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. Under the deal, the prisoners had agreed to plead guilty and be sentenced to life in prison. But on Friday, Austin rescinded the deal in a move that will put the death penalty back on the table for the three men. For more, we're joined in Boston by Terry Rockefeller, a member of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Her sister, Laura, died in the World Trade Center attacks. Terry, it's supported the plea deal. Here in New York, Shaina Khadidal is the managing attorney of the Guantanamo Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Shaina, let's begin with you. It was a surprise first to hear this plea deal was worked out. I mean, they've been at Guantanamo for decades, these three men. They stay in prison for the rest of their lives, but death penalty was off the table. And then it was another shock to see that the defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, had vetoed the deal. Explain what happened.
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, the prosecutors wanted this deal badly, right? Because I think they understood, as anyone else who's observed this process understands, that the death penalty was never going to happen in these cases for a bunch of reasons, right? There's a common misconception that the issue is torture evidence. There's actually a lot of evidence that isn't contaminated by torture, including, you know, pre-detention confessions to Al Jazeera that KSM made, cooperating witnesses, and so forth. The problem is more, you know, when you get to sentencing.
When you say torture evidence. You're saying that the fact that, for example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded about 100 times contaminated his so-called confession.
It contaminated a lot of the confessions, obviously, that took place in detention. The military has, prosecutors have made a great number of attempts to keep some of the confessions that allegedly happened after they were brought to Guantanamo and after the worst of the CIA torture supposedly stopped. And that's one reason these cases have dragged on for so long. But, you know, putting to one side the fact that it would take years to get to trial and years after any death sentence to enforce it, and these defendants are in their mid-50s, you know, there are also problems at the sentencing phase, right? The CIA is never going to want to produce its witnesses. They've already shown that in other cases, witnesses to the torture that the defendants could put on to show what happened to them in arguing for clemency and arguing against the death penalty, right? And then they also fear what the military juries might do after they hear the evidence of torture.
And when you say military juries, explain that these are not brought into regular courts.
Right, right. If they had been brought to federal court, we'd get a jury of civilians here in New York. In the military commissions, you get a jury of military officers. But we had a client who was horribly tortured, who pled guilty to some offenses linked to al-Qaeda. And the military jury kind of showed that in a statement that they issued afterwards, that they really were troubled by what they had seen in terms of his torture. And so this is a concern for the prosecutors.
And finally, people might be surprised that the defense secretary gets to decide this.
Well, he really doesn't, right? Lloyd Austin is the original convening authority, the person in charge of the military commissions, but he delegated all of his power to General Escalier, who made the decision to sign off on these agreements, right? So there's a really significant question here whether or not what Austin did in removing Escalier from her role in approving these agreements and purporting to withdraw the agreements, there's a real question about whether it's legal, right? Under the manual for military commissions, there are very narrow circumstances where he can withdraw an agreement that's already been signed, right? And then beyond that, there are going to be legal challenges based on command influence. You know, in the civilian system, Donald Trump can remove the attorney general if he doesn't like a prosecution, but generally the AG is supposed to operate independently, but that's based on norms. In the military system, it's all written into the two major statutes. So there are going to be significant challenges to both whether the withdrawal is legal and effective and whether it involves command influence, and the remedy for command influence is dismissal of the charges. So, you know, yet another chapter in the ongoing train wreck that is the military commissions.
I want to bring Terry Rockefeller into this conversation. Terry's sister, Laura, died on 9/11, on September 11, 2001, at the World Trade Center. She's with September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Your response to the plea deal originally, it's something you have called for, and then Lloyd Austin nixing it.
Well, you know, I think, Amy, every time we speak, it seems that it's, you know, one more instance of just the terrible ongoing repercussions of the very bad decisions that were made in the immediate wake of 9/11. September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows had initially hoped that we would see trials in federal court. We know that the federal courts are very competent in handling terrorism cases and very competent in handling cases where there is a great deal of classified information. That didn't happen. We had politicians in New York blocking that. So we became very invested in figuring out just what was going to go on in the military commissions. And frankly, you know, I'm looking back now. I was present for the arraignment of the then five men who had been accused of supporting the 9/11 attacks. That was in May of 2012. Within 5 years, the members of our organization grew convinced that we were never going to see a trial. And we were also keenly aware of the number of victim family members who were dying without seeing justice. We began working very hard for plea agreements. There was one iteration that was initiated, and I always emphasize, it's important to understand, and many of the politicians who don't really understand what is ongoing at Guantanamo don't appreciate that it was the prosecution that sought plea agreements because they themselves recognized the very difficult case they had on their hands. When the first attempt fell through, we were frustrated, but we were frankly totally surprised by the announcement that three of the men had completed their agreements. And I guess I felt relief. I thought about how finally there was going to be not the complete rule of law that we would have wanted to see, but an opportunity for some accountability, and more importantly, some kind of judicial finality. When that was revoked within, you know, such a short period of time, I just feel like once again we're on uncharted waters, and I'm so sad for our country that we haven't been able to grapple with the mistakes that were made in handling this case and come to terms with those mistakes and rescue something about the rule of law in this nation so that we can move forward as a country.
Terry, Defense Secretary Austin cited the emotions and desires of 9/11 families as justification for revoking the plea deal. If you can respond to that and what you would say to those who might be using your family's loss to justify this revocation.
I think the range of opinions and feelings among 9/11 family members is so diverse that I wouldn't want I don't want to characterize them. I want it to be very clear that as a group of people and the only organization that has the capacity to go down to Guantanamo and attend the ongoing pretrial hearings as a representative of an NGO. So we have an opportunity to speak to both sides, both the prosecution and the defense. And I think that had family members actually gotten all the opportunities that the plea agreement promised us, many, many of them would have been satisfied. The plea agreement included an opportunity for family members to pose questions to the defendants and get those answers within 45 days. Many of the family members who are awaiting trial are really eager to learn about many issues that go far beyond the roles of the five men who were accused, now down to four men because one of them has been ruled incompetent to stand trial. But I think if we, as a diverse community of people who lost family members, had an opportunity to really take advantage of what the plea agreements offered, we might be a lot further along as a nation toward reaching some kind of understanding.
Terry Rockefeller, I want to thank you so much for being with us. You lost your sister on 9/11. And this last fact, it cost $500 million to run the Guantanamo prison. Something like $13 million for each of the 30 prisoners left. Compare that to something like $78,000. It's $13 million per prisoner in Guantanamo, $78,000 for people, for prisoners at Supermax held at a federal prison. That does it for our show. Shaina Katyal of Center for Constitutional Rights, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablais.